Well, thank you for the very kind introduction. It's hard to be a theorist in the presence of skeptical experimentalists. Okay, so indeed, at least it's new to me, this way of looking at the pseudo-gap. So for this audience, I don't need to introduce this pseudo-gap phenomenology. It's roughly this part of the phase diagram. I think it's this field, of course, has a long history. The field of high TC is full of baggages. But I think it's generally considered that this is a core issue of the high TC puzzle. Right? People often refer to this as the enigmatic pseudo-gap phase or so on, because it has so many unusual properties that we cannot explain in a simple way. So of course, that reminds me of the old story of the blind man and the elephant. And so the question is, of course, what is the elephant? Right? All the blind people here are my experimental friends. there are a number of common themes that goes with this. One is that the pseudo-gap is a competing order phase. Some other thing is competing with the superconductivity. Another theme is that it's a kind of fluctuating superconductor. Superconductivity is fluctuating even up to high temperature. And for a long time, we've been advocating some kind of an RVB state, that the pseudo-gap should be sort of a spin gap, singlet, breaking of singlet. So let me give my my bottom line from the beginning in case you're dozing off. My answer, just as in the blind man and elephant story, is that everybody's right. Okay, so everybody is happy. The answer is all of the above. Okay, it's all of the above, except that the competing order is a new kind of fluctuating superconductor. So this is something that people don't seem to have considered before. People have talked about charge density wave, charge order, any kinds of order. But my thesis is that what underlies the pseudo-gap is actually a kind of superconducting fluctuation, but different from the usual D-wave. It's a different kind, okay? And its microscopic origin has to do with spin charge separation. So in this sense, all these ideas has some elements of truth in it. Okay, so that's the idea. And yeah, so now I think interest in this pseudo-gap has been revived, I think significantly due to the discovery of charge order in this material in the last few years. So what is discovered is that there is a charge density wave with medium range and or quasi-static order, right? They're not long range in space, but with quite long range, 20 spacing or so. And it competes with superconductivity, right? So this is famous data that when superconductivity arises, then the charge order diffraction decreases, right? So it's obviously a competing phase, and the order grows as you decrease the temperature, okay? So this is it's kind of a general phase diagram. There's too much information here, but generally speaking, there's a transition temperature. There's a long history of pseudo-gap, many different measurements. They're all a little bit different, but just say that there's a broad smear of things. And the new discovery is this thing here that lives up to about 180, 150 Kelvin, this boundary of charge order, okay? And it seems to have also a dome shape. That's the new information. And disappear below 8%. So it lives between 8% and this famous 19% somewhere here. Okay, so that's the new experiment. Now, I think a very important observation for me is that I think there's evidence that this charge ordering is quite distinct from the stripes that have been discussed extensively in the context of LBCO. One important difference is that the wave vector for the stripe phase was well characterized, that it increases as you increase doping up to, and it's maximum at 1/8. And beyond that, it kind of saturates, right? So it's an increasing function with doping. Whereas for this newly discovered charge order, the wave factor is decreasing with doping. Okay, so it has the opposite trend than a kind of stripe picture where you just add carriers to the stripe, okay? And so this was actually first seen by Eric Hudson in his STM, this trend, and now confirmed by the by all these direct X-ray measurements. Another point is that the spin fluctuation is an integral part. As far as I understand it, the anti-phase domain made by the spin is an integral part of the stripe order, so that the spin density is always at a wave vector which is half of the stripe vector. In this case, the spin fluctuation is at a totally different wave vector entirely. It's also incommensurate, but it's something unrelated to this place. Okay, so I think this is a new beast. I'd like to say that I feel very liberating. We are liberating. I feel liberated from the tyranny of stripes, and so this this may be some new object. Okay. Now I claim that my proposal explains everything, with the exception that I'm not going to talk about intracell order such as loop currents. And then the other important thing that I cannot explain is I would not be able to explain is the time reversal symmetry, the Curry effect. But I just learned that Daniel Achterberg here has actually made some progress. He made some extension of what I was talking about, and he has a story about these two issues. So I think hopefully he will talk about it on Thursday, but if he doesn't, ask him. So any questions about time reversal and orbital current, you can ask Daniel. Okay, so this is a picture in support of competing order, right? And and a lot of people think that, well, charge stripes or fluctuating evident version thereof or pneumatic version is the pseudo-gap phase as a competing phase. On the other hand, there's also evidence that there's a strong superconducting fluctuation about TC. Now, this is controversial because, this is a blind man story. Different blind men have different stories. So Ong's group, for a long time, has insisted that they're fluctuating superconductivity up to many times TC, several times TC, right? Up to about 150 Kelvin or so, okay? Now, other groups, like Louis Taillefer and many other people, says that, oh, the fluctuating superconductivity lives only about 20 Kelvin above TC, the convention, and you can describe it by conventional fluctuation. Okay, both are right. I'll show you. So at least there are these claims out there that there are that fluctuating diamagnetism. So they make very sensitive measurement of the diamagnetism and show that there's diamagnetism at very high temperature. But I think a more impressive set of data that is not so well, I don't think it's so well appreciated. It's some data from Christian Bernhardt's group, where they measure the optical conductivity between the bilayer. You know, the YBCO has two tightly bound, very close together bilayer. They're coupled, tightly bound. And so they basically measure the optical conductivity between the bilayer. So it has a Judith-like thing above TC. Okay, but the amazing thing is that as you lower the temperature from room temperature, the Judith weight actually increases. Right, you can see that the red thing, as you lower the temperature, both the it's just that area under that clearly increases. Okay, so as you enter the pseudo gap phase, the Judah weight actually increases as you lower the temperature. And of course, when you go to the superconductor, then it dies. Right, the weight is shifted to the delta function in the usual way. Right, so it dies and then the weight. Right, so how do we get the Judah weight of the conductivity that increases? If you have a charge, any kind of charge order, you expect the opposite because you're going towards an insulator. The Judah weight should be pushed up to a high frequency, right? So the only sensible thing that people have is that it's something. If you have a fluctuating superconductor, then the Judah weight would pile in, right? And the width of this can be considered the lifetime of the fluctuating superconductor. Okay, so. And in this picture, then in this bilayer, the increases starts around 180 Kelvin, which is roughly of the scale, and also the scale that people associate with some kind of pseudo gap. Okay, right. So this is evidence supporting the second point of view. Okay. Now, another set of very important data is a few years ago, a ZX group published office data on single layer BISCO, one layer BISCO, very a detailed study. So these are office scans and where you take cuts. So this is the canonical band, right? So the band picture, and these are cuts along here. So for example, this first figure is the cut right through the saddle point. There's a saddle point here, right? And the red line is a high temperature data, right? High temperature data. So the high temperature, so to get oriented, this is exactly what you expect. This is a saddle point. So as you move away from the saddle point, this thing moves down, gets deeper and deeper, and the K Fermi increases, right? Is that clear to everyone what I'm plotting, right? So the red line is the cut of the along the Fermi surface, and this is the conducting band, right? People seem puzzled, right? It's okay, right? So that's the saddle point, right? Now, as you go into the zero gap or low temperature, what happens is that something developed below this bottom of the band. There's some weight that below, way below. So it's these dots are always misleading, so you always have to look at the raw data, right? You cannot trust these dots. But basically, the point is that the weight below, far below, developed far below this. First, the new weight developed 100 millivolts, right? Way below this Fermi energy. And the second is that there seems to be a peak there near the Fermi energy. And as you make these cuts, this peak rises and eventually meets the Fermi level, right? When it meets the Fermi level, that's the end of the pseudo gap. So this will be the pseudo gap, right? Because it's gapped. But as you go towards here, eventually you go to the end of the gap, which is the beginning of the Fermi arc, right? And you can see clearly that happening. Okay, so that much of the data is pretty clear. Now, the experimentalists made a point that the top of this peak in this band does not line up with the Fermi surface, right? It doesn't look very clear, but actually if you blow it up, you can see that this thing, which they call KG2, is about twice the Fermi energy. Okay, it's a substantial effect. Okay, now if you have a superconducting fluctuation, or if you have conventional pairing, then the gap is always measured, always maximum at the KF, right? Because you hybridize, right? You have a Fermi level, you hybridize, right? So the top of the gap is always at KF, right? But this guy is shifted away from KF, okay? So they use this as an argument that the competing order is not pairing, okay? But what is it? Well, they try to explain it with as a charge density wave, but charge density wave also does not work. And here, let me make an argument that a charge density wave picture at the mean field level can never explain the Arpis data. And I make a rather strong statement, okay? If you look at the full data carefully, all right? So why is that? Well, again, let's look at this picture. This is a gap. And we are making scans, right, across here. So this is a scan right here. This is the next one. And the high TC is coming down, okay? Now, you may want to say that, I have some, let me just say that there's some charge density wave that connects these two points. And I just, so let's say that I make a charge density wave like this, right? Then, of course, you open the gap in the usual way, right? And if you just look at this thing, you may be quite happy. You say, okay, I have a pseudo gap here at the Fermi level, right? So this looks like a mechanism for a pseudo gap. And I would open a gap everywhere here, okay? But now you ask yourself, how does my pseudo gap terminate? How do I connect to the Fermi arc, right? Because we know that as you go down here, then the gap closes. So now you go down here, and now you see that for charge density wave, this period is fixed, so this thing doesn't move. And all that happens is that this thing moves down. So the only thing that can happen is that the gap moves down in energy, right? And eventually, it moves down sufficiently so that there's a state at the Fermi level, right? But notice that, at this point you would say, I'm also very happy because this is the Fermi arc, right? So I have a way of transitioning from a gap to the Fermi arc, and this is the end of the arc. But notice what happens is that this state at the Fermi level comes from above. It comes, the gap is closed by the state coming down from above, okay? And you always leave a big gap underneath. This is never seen. In experiment, the state that fills the gap always comes from below, as I show very clearly in this plot here. See, if you do this march, you see this gap is closing from below. and eventually meets the Fermi level. Okay? I maintain that you can never get this picture in a charged density situation. Yeah? You have to do something pretty dramatic to shift it, I would say.
No,
yeah. Okay, fine. Yeah, it has to be have substantial k dependence, I would say. Yeah, you have to tweak it. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So just to clarify, there's no way for this whole structure to be up in action instead of down.
Hmm?
So at the middle picture, is there
which picture?
Right. So in the middle picture, the middle picture you're presenting, right? You're explaining that in order to reconcile, one way is to think about this whole gap shifting to all different levels.
Right.
Is there any way within the main field to have the opposite?
No, not right. If you know how to do it, let me know. I think this argument is pretty robust. Yeah. Okay. So anyone? Yeah. So. Okay. So I think the charge is at the mean field level. I mean, if you at the mean field level, I think there's no chance that the charge density can be the source of this gap with the Fermi arc, and we have a lot more data to support this. For example, the Brookhaven group, right? Peter Johnson's group has studied this arc in detail by making cuts this way. And it's clear that the state is indeed moving. You know, you're closing the gap from below, right? When you hit the saddle point, and they even argue that, you know, there is a gap up above, right? That there's a gap. They claim that the gap is above, never below. No one has ever seen a gap below the Fermi point. The gap, if it's there, is above. Okay. So all these are part of the pseudo gap puzzle that I want to present to you, right? That's why. All these blind men are seeing, everybody is seeing different things, okay? And it's hard to reconcile. That's why it is an interesting and difficult problem. Okay, so back to theory land. The simplest model to describe the strong correlate. First of all, we believe that the ITC problem is the problem of doping a mod insulator. And the simplest model is a TJ model of this form. We don't allow double occupation for strong correlation, and we just decomposed electrons in fermions and bosons is a very old story. And we can enforce a constraint with Lagrange multiplier, like this. And the spin has a four-fermion representation which invites decoupling of this type. And you can easily see that the phase of this decoupling naturally gives rise to a lattice gauge field, a U1 gauge field. So the story is that for a long time we have argued that the TJ model, strong coupled TJ model, can be mapped onto a picture of fermions and bosons coupled to U1 gauge field. Okay. Now, at the mean field level, this problem was solved a long time ago when Gabi was a young man at MIT. He made, with a student, he made this mean field phase diagram, which was very controversial at the time because everyone believed that superconducting was S-wave, and every time I showed this, I had to apologize that, you know, we're getting the wrong state. Seriously, yeah. But the mean field gives you this nice picture, right? So the mean field picture already gives you a story for the pseudo-gap, because the pseudo-gap would be a spin-on pairing, right? So it's a spin-on pairing, and the gap is a spin gap in a spin channel. Right. So in a way, my story is just a modification of Gabi's story. You know, 40 years later. Is it 40 years? 30 years later. 30 years later. Right. Just a small modification. So slightly new. All I'm saying is that instead of considering this this D-wave pairing, there's another pairing state that may be competitive. Right. There may be another way that's competitive, and let's consider that possibility. So that's it. Okay, so since this session belongs partly to the organic, so let me say a few words about spin liquid. And so the spin liquid is actually a simpler problem, right? Compared with the doped insulator, it's the same Hamiltonian except that we're just dealing with an undoped mod insulator, right? So the great difficulty of the TJ model when doping is actually the boson, how to handle the boson. So the So the undoped problem is actually simpler. Then we only have spinons. We only have fermions coupled to gauge field. And fermions are much easier to handle because they're, fermion statistics protect you. Okay, and you notice that the prediction of the spin liquid is due to quantum fluctuations and so on. And now, I think 40 years later, we indeed have some examples of spin liquid. And the organic is, I think, the best studied example. And what happens is, I think now there is, for a long time, theory predicts that there are emergent properties, just such as these spinons that I talk about, coupled to gauge field. And I think there's strong evidence now that these spinons, fermionic spinons, exist. Okay, the gauge field is still not discovered. So this is Kanoda's famous material, the ET salt. And this part of the phase diagram is totally boring, which is good for us. It doesn't do anything. And under pressure, it becomes a superconductor. And it's an insulator here. And I think I can go through this very fast because I think these are famous results that there's a linear gamma term in the specific heat. And there are two kinds of material now, the ET salt and then this new one. And a similar gamma coefficient, quite large, millijoules per Kelvin square. It's kind of a medium weight fermion. These low energy excitations are mobile because they contribute to thermal conductivity. At least for the DMIT salt, the kappa over T goes to a constant, right? The characteristic of a fermion carrying heat. The ET salt seems to develop a very small gap, and it's not so clear. Is that an experimental issue or is it real? I think that's maybe still open. Okay, so that looks good. Oops, oh, I'm sorry. I pressed your computer by mistake. Somebody is sailing. How do I stop this? Okay, yeah, so now, but for my purpose, let me just point to an interesting thing, that for the ET salt, there's strong evidence that at 6 Kelvin, there's a phase transition, which is still not understood. Okay, that if you look at a specific heat, there's a peak here, right? And then there's a thermal expansion coefficient. There's definitely some phase transition going on. Okay, so the first thing that came to our mind, since we are wearing colored spin-on glasses, is that this may be due to spin-on pairing. And with lover's eyes, you can see a BCS jump here, right? So we proposed some kind of D-wave. But what kind of pairing is it? Well, it turns out that it cannot be a simple spin singlet pairing, because this thing is very robust. This 6 degree doesn't move up to 30 Tesla field. Right? So it's totally immune to magnetic field. It's very strange. So that led us to propose something very exotic, which we call Ampérian pairing. And let me explain that. So in this story, there's a transverse gauge fluctuation, which is magnetic field fluctuation, is most important. And so we propose that two electrons moving in the same direction can exchange this magnetic fluctuation and be attractive. Right? It's called Ampérian pairing because I had to teach freshman physics at one point. And I remember having to explain that Ampere's effect is, if you have two wires, if they carry the same current in the same direction, the wires attract. Right? And that's because this current is making a magnetic field as seen by this wire. So it's the same with electrons, the spin-on moving in the same direction, making a magnetic field, and it's attracted. So now it's spin-ons that are moving in the same direction that attract. So therefore, you would want to pair the spin-ons on the same side of the Fermi surface. So this is a radical departure from BCS theory, which pairs on opposite side, right? And it turns out that this pairing satisfies the condition that it is immune to magnetic field, even if it's a singlet pairing. Very, very interesting. I have to speed up a little bit. So a few years later, somehow I woke up one morning and say that, well, this is an idea that we can also apply to high TC. The only difference is that now we have two Fermi sphere, and this Umklapp term says that I want to pair here, so I want to pair here. I also want to pair here, right? So I have two pairing, K and minus K, right? And so from this point on, I will proceed phenomenologically. This story about Ampere effect is just a motivation for considering this crazy idea. So the crazy idea is to consider pairing where I pick a point, a symmetry point and a Fermi surface, and pair two electrons. Right? So immediately you notice that the pair now carries a momentum. Right? The total momentum is this, but by Umklapp it's actually this. Right? So this state is is now, we can call this a pair density wave because it carries a net current. Okay? So the first example of a pair density wave is the FFLO state. But that still pairs electrons on the opposite side, right? So this is more radical. We're pairing electrons on the same side, okay? And it turns out that this was also discussed in the context of stripes. Trancada discovered some two-dimensional fluctuating superconductor, and Berg and Kibelson had a very nice story, and Fracken had a very nice story about that. But I'm running out of time, so let me skip this quickly. But just to say that that's precedent. But let's example the consequence. So from now on, I'm just saying, let me just assume that I have these, what I call Ampérian pairing state with finite momentum. And what are the consequences? Okay. Well, the first consequence is that let's work out a spectrum. Now, again, I make this cut. And you can see that now I have this electron band. Now, usually, I take this and flip it around and make this hybridization. But now when I flip this around, I have to slide this over. Right, because I'm pairing with a finite k. When a slide is over, they still have a tangential point there, and therefore they will open a gap like this. This is a gap. But now notice the top of this is not at the Fermi level, but shifted out. So this explains the first observation, that the pseudo gap is shifted away, even though it's a pairing gap. Okay. And secondly, as I go away from this point, as I make this thing deeper, right, then the gap, you see this, great thing about pairing is that the gap is not fixed in k-space. It rises to the Fermi level. So now the gap rises as I go down. And the state now comes up to meet it from below. So this satisfies the second strange feature, that the pseudo gap, when it's filled in, is filled in by states that rises from below to meet the Fermi surface. Okay. Yeah, so the more detailed calculation shows this as a sequence of plot. You can see that, just call your attention to this one. This is my pseudo gap, and it rises. This is the end of the Fermi arc, and this is the Fermi arc showing it. Okay? And so now you can make a Fermi arc like this. You can see, so this at the mean field level, I want to emphasize, without doing any tweaking or fluctuating, at the mean field level, I can already get Fermi arc, right? Because this Ampérian pairing only pair stays around here. And it gives rise to something that looks very much like Peter Johnson was saying for a long time. Okay, now what are some other consequences? Another consequence is that this naturally produces a charge density wave, right? Because there's a time unit free energy that allows me to couple, if I have a pair density wave, then it naturally produces charge 2q, right? And this is the data from this plots the charge density wave Q like this. And this experimentalist kindly produced a plot of the Q vector that spans the nesting vector here. If I double that, I get the red line. Right? So it looks pretty good, right, to compare with that. Right? So this is twice the PDW, the pair density wave period. Okay. So in this picture, the important point is that the charge density wave is a subsidiary order. It's not the driver. It's just a secondary order. And it's just coming there for the ride. That's not that key play. Now, the pair density wave has a small superfluid density and is subject to large phase fluctuation. Okay, so we assume that the pair density wave has short range order only in most of the phase diagram. It's always fluctuating. Okay. However, even with the pair density wave is fluctuating, it's still possible to have long range order in the subsidiary order parameter. This sounds real strange. The primary order is fluctuating, but the pair is. But that possibility actually was already pointed out by Berg and Kibelson and Fredkin. So if you want to blame somebody, blame them. Yeah, right. I'll credit them. Okay. So here's my phase diagram. Right. So we assume that there's a fluctuating pair density wave phase. So this is my pseudo gap. Everything in here is fluctuating. Okay. I'm extremely proud of this phase diagram because I made it myself. Not so much the physics. So this whole thing is fluctuating. And underneath here, there can be charge density order. And this is true long range order in the absence of disorder. Okay? And now there's at some low temperature, the D density D superconductor shows up, right? Wins the competition. And above here, there's a range of conventional superconducting fluctuation. So this is what Tai Fei and other people are seeing. This fluctuation is what Ong and Christian Bernhard is seeing. So everybody's right, see? Okay? And now, as you increase the magnetic field, one of the amazing features is that HC2 is very, very low. And this also can have an explanation. 5 minutes, great. This can have an explanation because, another point is that as this competition, as this d-density, as the d-wave order appears, then it can coexist with the pseudo-gap because the pseudo-gap is already there. And that's exactly what is seen in ARPES by Vishik, right? The d-wave here runs into, at high temperature you have this pseudo-gap. It's a different object, but you can see that at low temperature they coexist, right? So the d-wave is not just a conventional thing, but it's a kink. So that again suggests that it's coexisting of two phases, okay? And the pair density wave is a normal state that sits in the vortex core, because what sits in the core is just whichever is here. So in our story, is something that very close in energy, free energy. And therefore, the core is large. And that explains why the HC2 is very small, because the core overlaps at very low field. And so now in this picture, as you apply the field, first you have the vortex solid. At high temperature, you have a vortex liquid phase, as usual. But beyond a very small HC2, this region is exactly the same as the pair density wave, fluctuating pair density wave phase. Right? So you go into this metallic phase, which is actually a fluctuating pair density wave state. This picture also explains the quantum oscillations. And this, I'm just borrowing the work of Harrison and Sebastian, which I think is gaining a lot of traction now. They say that this electron pocket is due to reflection from a charge density wave. But for this to work, you need bi-directional charge density wave. Okay, and we have that in our story. Okay. Now, is there a smoking gun experiment? And here I want the experimentalists to wake up. Can we directly measure the fluctuating pair density wave? And the answer is yes, right? Because this is an idea Scalpino had proposed 40 years ago, 50 years ago, 1960s. And that is that you can probe the fluctuation pair correlation function in space and time by doing a Josephson tunneling with a regular superconductor. And you can apply magnetic field parallel to the plane, and that provides you with a Q, with a momentum transfer. Okay? So if you do a conventional experiment, you would see, in Josephson, you would see a Fraunhofer pattern. So this just says that we expect to see a shifted pattern. The peak will be shifted to some finite B. Of course, it will be quite broadened and so on, right? So it will not be so easy to see. I'm already looking for a backdoor escape. But but in principle, this should be there, okay? So there should be two peak. I had a very good referee for my, and he called my attention to this paper. Turns out that this kind of structure was already fabricated 6 years ago by the French group, who used this to study this small fluctuation above TC. And they exactly saw this fluctuation 20 degrees above TC, okay? But they have the structure. Of course, I got very excited. I contacted them, and they said, well, the person who grew this structure has retired, and now no one in my lab can grow this anymore. So that's my bad luck, because all they had to do is to take this thing and apply magnetic field, and that's the experiment. So I appeal to anyone in experimentalists or friends in the audience, they can do this, okay? Another question is there other order, right? We predicted order 2q1, 2q2. Q1 is in the x direction, q2 in the y direction. A common one is q1 plus q2. Okay. Turns out that there's a very nice paper by Daniel Achterberg and Sunesugu, who made the case that that you can either see charge density wave order or an orbital magnetization order, not both. Now, this Q1 plus Q2 order has been looked for, but not seen. So we're probably in this situation. So this is something that neutron scattering have a chance to look for at Q1 plus Q2, okay? Another question is that if I go to low temperature and a D-wave state, does the D-wave order induce this long-range order of a pair density wave? Well, there is a term in the Landau theory that could do that. And again, I think the short answer is that it's possible that it induces that. But once it's induced, then this theory predicts that there is a order get Q1 itself, because this term is now allowed, right? This carries zero momentum, right? Okay. Now, so let me just close by saying that there is indeed some data from Nai Chan Ye's group who are the only people who can do STM on YBCO. And many years ago, she reported seeing dispersionless features at 2 Qs. And this higher Q is at 0.28. Now this is exactly where it should be, because this is optimally doped, and this has been seen at exactly 0.28. So there's some credibility to this. But in addition, she saw something at half that period. So is this the Q1 that I'm looking for? Who knows, right? Okay, so to conclude, I think the Empyrean pairing story is a phenomenological assumption. I make one assumption, and I claim to explain naturally many of the features associated with the pseudo gap. Is this the long sought after mother state? Right? We always think that there's a mother state hiding behind this pseudo gap. I think we desperately need an experiment, because I don't think I can convince people just by waving my hands, particularly my friend, my skeptical friends here. Yeah. So all these blind people we need some experiment. And of course, some provocative question is that, is there a way to stabilize this pair density wave, right? Because it's cued by phase fluctuation. If I can make very closely paired, maybe I can actually stabilize it as a phase, right?
Thank you very much, Patrick.
So your motivation was the Empyrean pairing from the U1 gauge fluctuations in the spin-ons, in the spin liquid.
And right.
Then you switched, I think, to electrons with Empyrean
pairing. Yes, I switched to electrons.
That's what you want. And so what's the origin of that?
I mean, there's no origin. Just make a story, just to motivate a little bit, because otherwise I would be accused of being even more crazy than I am.
Yes, very nice talk. And I agree with what you said, partly because we said that 5 years ago. Okay.
So nothing is new.
Okay, so let me make a point, however, that I think, in spite of what you said at the beginning, the lanthanum materials are more like YBCO than what you made it, in spite of some differences. Mm-hmm. We infer the existence of this pair density wave based on the phenomenology of the lanthanum materials. Mm-hmm. In fact, many of the predictions that you have at the end are things that are in our papers from 2009
sure.
already.
Yeah.
So I think this type of state is probably lurking in the background and is in some sense a natural competitor, because since it tends to make gaps, it's a natural candidate for a pseudo gap state rather than other states that have a hard time making gaps in the first place.
Very good.
You already gave almost answer to the question I wanted to ask, but I understand that's phenomenology. But suppose you take as phenomenology that your pair density wave exists. Is it possible to explain its doping dependence? Because you draw a picture with the line going down and disappearing in some particular doping. Is there any reasoning for this besides this word phenomenology?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, it's for the same reason why the D wave was coming down, right? I guess. Yeah, I hadn't thought about it seriously. Yeah.
Okay, so there's a problem in principle with stabilizing pair density wave long range order,
mm-hmm.
which is that the charge density wave component of the pair density wave couples to disorder.
Yeah.
And so unlike ordinary superconductivity, which is protected by gauge invariance mm-hmm. from having any serious effects of disorder, this will produce effectively random J's. It will mm-hmm. become like an XY spin glass,
mm-hmm. yeah.
Which certainly won't have long range order. In two dimensions, it won't even have a spin glass phase.
Yeah, first of all, I only treat the clean case. Even in a disordered case, as a glassy superconductor is a superconductor.
No, I understand. But in two dimensions, you don't have an XY spin glass phase. Mm-hmm. So there isn't, in two dimensions, any true long-range superconducting phase.
That's not so essential to me.
But
it's a good point.
No, it may not be essential in theory. I agree with that. But in experiment, there.
No, but even an experiment, disorder. Because I think a glassy, two-dimensional pin pair density wave would have a lot of property that's similar to a superconductor. It's a glassy superconductor.
But it won't have. You can't have
Yeah, but I don't care. Well, I would have enhanced, I would have hugely enhanced currents.
I have a phenomenological question and a theoretical question. Basically, I follow your argument about the RPAS data, about the dispersion relation, but I want to comment that all the data you showed is at 10K.
So not all of them.
I think the panels, the pictures you showed, is it?
No, they vary. Yeah, anyway, go ahead.
Okay. And I just think maybe if you include superconducting gap of momentum zero, the dispersion we'll get will be further complicated.
Yeah, so actually the data is in both places. Yeah. So the green thing is actually the effect of superconductor, which I didn't touch on. The green thing is what showed up below TC at low temperature. And this is above TC, the blue thing.
This is, yes.
It's 10K, right? So this, oh, the 10K is below TC, and then...
this is above TC.
Yeah, I guess this is above, this is less than less than TC, it says 10K.
Yeah.
Less than TC, yeah. So yeah, that then is showing this green things. The green thing is the effect of the D-wave pairing.
Yeah. I said I have another theoretical. Yeah. Yes.
Okay.
We could. So theoretical question. I don't quite understand why this pair density wave is bound at the Burden zone boundary. Why do you have to sit right on the tip of?
Yeah, that's actually a very good question. That is an assumption on my part, and I think it's reasonable a weak coupling, because I have to pick a point. And so this is my confession. We my student actually did some microscopic calculation, mean field calculation, and when you do it for strong coupling, the pairing wave vector move away from the 2KF. It moves actually inside the Fermi surface. It moves into the Fermi surface. So and potentially that could cause me a problem. Yeah. But it should be tied to more or less tied to the 2KF. I'm just saying I cannot say that it's exactly 2KF in strong coupling.
There is some evidence that in YBCO and BISCO, the CDW has a kind of local D-wave form factor. Is there a reason that would come out?
I think that is not that easy, not that difficult to find, because if you insist on just Coulomb, it can just be coming from Coulomb charging energy, because the hose is living on the bond, on the oxygen which sits in the bond, right? So if you insist on charge neutrality, then you naturally come up with a D-wave form factor. And I think this is probably beyond the theory that we have. Because first of all, I only have a one-band model. Right? If I put a three-band model, I have a better chance. And if I put on top of that Coulomb repulsion, if I put in enough, I can probably do it.
But
yeah.
Does it have to
explain? I don't know. I didn't know that. Yeah.
A quick question. Do you think this would provide an explanation of the linear resistivity, or is it something extrinsic
to that?
No,
that's something I haven't touched yet.
Touch
yeah.
It. Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, last question.
Hi, Patrick. That's a very interesting and exotic explanation you have. But one point I would like to raise is this question of whether this is really a giant phonon anomaly or a fluctuating charge density wave. And you mentioned that you were focusing on the clean limit, mm-hmm. but there is one, you know, underdoped clean pseudo gap material, namely the 2 version of YBCO.
Mm-hmm.
And because it's so clean, you can get very nice NMR patterns
mm-hmm.
and see the charge distribution through the NMR.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, these patterns at all temperatures reproduce the charge distribution that people found in a priori LDA calculations.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they do see, and NMR does see, some low frequency, which of course operates at low frequency, anomalous charge fluctuations,
mm-hmm.
but they rise as you approach TC and then drop below TC.
Mm.
But at no point do they see a static charge order, which if I heard you right, you were actually saying should occur in the clean limit.
Yeah, I would say so, yeah. So I don't know whether the X-ray experiment has been done on the 1-2-4. It should be done, yeah. Yeah, NMR is a little tricky to interpret, as you know,
Okay, thank you very much, Patrick.
So next presentation this morning is by Juan Carlos Campuzano, and it has the enigmatic title of TBA.